This is the American Ag Network Week in Review. In the show today, Rusty Halvorsen gets us caught up on the week's top news.
The farm show season is well underway. Our microphones have traveled to Dakota Fest in Mitchell, South Dakota, Decatur, Illinois for the Farm Progress Show, and also this past week to Prosper, North Dakota for the Peterson Farms Seed Field Day. We talked with Carl Peterson.
Okay, so we're at the annual field day. A little shot of rain last night. How are things looking here in the plots?
We've got great looking plots. We got sunshine, a little breeze today, so things are drying up. We're able to get around. Might have a little bit of mud on my shoes, but, you know, that's not that unusual.
Yeah. For the growers you just addressed here in the tent, any common questions that you're encountering this year, Carl?
Not so much that I've gotten today at field day, but, you know, this has been a very difficult year for farmers with all of the rains and delayed planting, and now the end of summer a little cool, and yeah. Plus the trade situation. It's not an easy time on the farm, so, you know, I think farmers generally are sort of, you know, trying to plan their way forward.
Yeah, I think we're looking to next year. We're already into the wheat around here on the drive up. We want the corn and beans to get through the finish line, and that's all we can hope for.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. But, you know, our goal for this field day is to have growers leave with information they can use on their farms next year. Now, not just about new corn products and soybean products, although they're certainly here, but that's why we have Paul Yasa talking about planter settings and Ken Ferry talking about plant structure and Jason Hansen talking about, you know, various aspects of agronomy, because that's really the focus of this day.
Okay. Well, thanks for your time on this day. You're busy. Thank you, Carl.
You bet.
Okay.
Meanwhile, the U.S. Meat Export Federation held a media conference call on Thursday featuring U.S. agricultural leaders who are in Japan as part of the USMEF's Heartland team, that group visiting through Saturday. Dan Holmstrom, USMEF president and CEO, says the timing of the trip to Japan is perfect.
We actually just came from a seminar and a dinner with tasting of U.S. beef and pork products. We had about 325 people at this seminar, which was really a cross-section of the entire trade in Japan, including importers, distributors, retailers, and food service operators, and some other sectors as well. So we've had a full week already, a couple more days to go, but it's been good so far in that regard.
In fact, I visited with a couple of North Dakota beef producers that are taking part of that Heartland team trip.
All right. Well, first off, just a little bit of your background, where you're both from, and what kind of operations do you have, maybe cow-calf, backgrounding. What do you guys kind of do?
So this is Clark, and I actually have a cow-calf operation at Hensler, Washburn area, north of Bismarck, about 40 miles. I run a 2,500 feed yard as well as some stockers. I feed cattle to finish and background some as well. So little diversified operation, as well as raising corn, soybeans, and wheat.
Yeah, Mark, well, we have a cow-calf operation in western McKenzie County. So that's basically what we do. We've got some irrigated ground. We pull some water out of the Yellowstone River and raise some feed.
Okay, thank you. Now, you're obviously in Japan, and one question I had when I was in the shower this morning thinking about our visit today, I thought, you know, how did you end up on a plane to Japan? How did you guys get picked to go on this trip?
So, this is from Clark, and my standpoint is, so I've been involved in the Beef Commission for now, I think, around 8 years, and I've been involved at the national level on the Export Growth Committee through NCBA and the Federation Division, and done some stuff there and been very involved in the export markets through the years. And then got the opportunity, and by USMEF, got asked to come over here and really promote U.S. beef and try to, you know, introduce some new products, put a face with the product, really to build that trust level with the consumers in Japan to help promote our product over here. This is our number one export market for U.S. beef, so it's a big important thing for them to build trust with the U.S. producer. So that was really the incentive to come over here and make that connection.
For myself, I've been on the Beef Commission a couple years now, and this involvement from our state level with the Meat Export Federation has continued to grow over the years. Prior to myself being on the Beef Commission, just seeing the importance of, as Clark said, growing this export business. And so we've gotten more and more involved, and this Heartland trip has been going on for a few years, but it's the first time that we've had some representation here. And so really, as far as why I'm here, is there were a couple of us that expressed some interest in going, and I drew the lucky straw out of the hat that got to go, and they're like in any committee or commission, there's people that have more interest in certain things than others, and this certainly has been something that I've been interested in is becoming more involved in and being more of an ambassador of is our involvement in the export business from North Dakota's perspective.
Okay, well, you're having face-to-face meetings. As you mentioned, you're putting a face to the product. And we recently had some news of the age requirements being lifted for some of our beef exports to Japan. Obviously, probably a big impact there. How's your experience been? The reception, has it been friendly? Are you enjoying yourselves?
Yeah, so the 30-month and over, thing we had done early this summer has really been a big boost for the Japanese consumer, because it's another level of product that they can actually is affordable to them. The Wagyu product, their domestic product that they have over here, is very expensive. It's consumed by a small percentage of the Japanese people. So we have a high-end corn-fed beef product, which is our normal product that we ship over here. And then once we got access to the 30-month and over, it kind of gave us access back to that fed cow market, some middle meats out of the fed cow, the offal, the tongue, the variety meat stuff that comes with that. So it adds a lot of value to the U.S. producer as well as the Japanese consumer, being able to afford some U.S. beef that they didn't normally, weren't able to afford before.
Another thing, too, with this, another acronym to get used to reading about and whatnot is PMO, 30 months and older, but is one of the featured items that was served tonight at a meeting that we were at with meat purveyors and meat traders and people involved in the packing industry. There's about 300 of them. But anyways, one of the entrees was ground beef on a bun, which we take for granted in the States. But one thing that they're going to be doing in Japan is, as Clark said, buying some of these middle meats whole over there and then grinding that once they get to Japan and serving that as a gourmet burger. And I think that could be, and I think the Japanese too, Meat Export Federation people, I think that's going to be a very, very big product in Japan.
Yeah, and the work that the U.S. Meat Export Federation does in that Southeast Asian market is just phenomenal. And you led me into my next and probably a final question. How is the food? Are you guys enjoying the meals that you're having over there?
You know what? The meals that we have with U.S. beef in them are fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic. The Asian food that we've eaten in the Asian market are, something that I'm not used to every day. Different. It's a different little, some raw fish and a little bit of different things there. Not something I'm used to eating every day, but it's been good. I mean, most of our meals have been very good.
Yeah, they have been. I'm not much of an experimental eater, so some of these things I shy away from. Versus Clark, he's like a garbage disposal. He'll eat anything. So he's doing well. So, it hasn't set him back too much, but the food that we've had through the MEF programs and whatnot have been fantastic.
USDA has opened enrollment for the main commodity programs in the Farm Bill, the Agriculture Risk Coverage and Price Loss Coverage programs. Enrollment is open for the 2019 crop year. Farmers have until March 15th, 2020 to sign up for the programs for 2019. Enrollment beginning this week for the 2019 crop year, but farmers can enroll for the 2020 crop year starting October 7th and continuing until June 30th. If you want to wait, you can sign up for both the 2019 and 2020 crop years during the same visit after October 7th. Trading at the Board of Trade expected to stay quiet and low volume until this coming Thursday, when USDA will release its next supply and demand numbers. Thursday's report from the EIA this past week may have a bearish effect on corn futures going into next week. A drop in U.S. ethanol production could confirm that USDA will be forced to lower its estimate of corn used for ethanol in next week's WASD report. The industry, suffering from weaker prices and oversupply, producers including Green Plains and Poet have closed plants over the past year in Indiana, Iowa, Minnesota, and other states. Minnesota Corn Board member Kirby Hetfer says they've shared their thoughts with the White House.
We did issue a call to action, a dual-purpose call to action here a couple weeks back, and over 700 corn farmers from the state of Minnesota responded. The one call that we had him do was directly to President Trump, asking that he fulfill his promise to keep the renewable fuel standard whole. And the other was during the comments that EPA had opened for the RVO, renewal volume obligation. So we did ask our members to participate in both of those call to actions. And, it's great to have 700 members across the state that responded. That's a pretty good showing. It took a little bit of communicating. You know, we had a lot of calls to the office and a lot of calls wondering what Corn Growers was doing. And, you know, we pointed them in the direction for the call to action. And like I said, we had over 700 responses by Corn Growers in Minnesota.
Ethanol futures have fallen most of this summer.
I don't think you can talk to anybody involved in the ethanol industry and have a positive spin out of any of those conversations regarding these waivers. There's no doubt it's hurt demand. There are plants that are adjusting production, some plants idling, which ultimately that destroys our corn grind demand and it's negative all the way around. These waivers really have done harm in rural America.
Executives for major oil refiners are urging the president not to move forward with proposed changes to the Renewable Fuel Standard Program meant to boost biofuel usage. The president expected to boost mandates in response to complaints from farmers about the administration's policy of issuing a growing number of refinery waivers. Chris Bliley, Vice President of Regulatory Affairs for Growth Energy, says there's a lot at stake with the president's decision.
Particularly as we look across rural America and we've seen plant closings and we have hundreds of millions of gallons offline. And, you know, we've lost 4 billion plus gallons of biofuel demand with these small refinery exemptions. And so we're certainly encouraged that the president has called on EPA to make this right. We're certainly anxiously awaiting the details of what this package may or may not be. And, you know, it's imperative that EPA properly account for these small refinery exemptions and restore that lost biofuel demand. And so we can start to recover at some of these plants. And it's some of the farms that supply these plants.
U.S. farmers say they're getting more pessimistic on the ag economy and more optimistic on government support payments. That, according to the Ag Economy Barometer from the CME and Purdue University. Purdue ag economist Michael Langemeyer was not surprised.
When we did the July survey, we were pretty much at the peak of prices, you know, corn prices. And then the August survey took place, for the most part, after the August 12th crop report. And as we know, there was a lot more corn acreage than the trade expected, and corn prices have tumbled.
It's been a roller coaster for the barometer since the month of May. Meanwhile, Morningstar Farms, a division of Kellogg that makes vegetarian food, said this week it is adding the Incogmeato plant-based meat product line onto grocery shelves in early 2020. Kellogg is not alone when it comes to stepping up its alternative meat offerings amid growth at Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods. ConAgra Brands has said it wants to grow its Guardian meat alternative brand Spam maker Hormel Foods entering the increasingly crowded meat alternative race, debuting a soy-based product meant to approximate ground meat under the moniker Happy Little Plants, and Tyson dipping further into vegan-friendly alternatives, its venture capital unit investing in New Wave Foods, a San Francisco-based developer of plant-based shellfish replacements. Terry Fleck, the executive director for the Center for Food Integrity, says his organization has investigated whether consumers are confused about all these new food alternatives.
Here at the center, we were just curious to understand consumer viewpoint around labeling terminology, particularly the terms milk and meat. And, you know, as we did that, we know that shoppers are smart enough to know the difference. They know there's no butter in peanut butter. You don't milk almonds. Gummy bears and hot dogs don't come from bears and dogs. So they know that difference. And we also were able to discover, at least for us, and we've seen research around this in a couple other places as well, that why shoppers are drawn to the alternative. What's the motivation? What's the perception? And it's really behind better health and wellness. It's around concerns over environmental sustainability, use of antibiotics, and animal care and handling. But what we did find in the research was some confusion and certainly some uncertainty around, particularly around what healthy means in the use of traditional terms like milk and meat. So, again, we know they're drawn to alternatives with the belief that maybe the alternative will offer a better health outcome. Maybe it's better for people's animals and the planet if I eat the alternatives. But what they're finding out is the confusion and the challenge in what was simply a quest to find a substitute is probably functionally more complex than what they thought.
That's what's happening this week in agriculture. I'm Rusty Halverson.
This has been the American Ag Network Week in Review. I'm Sabrina Hill for Rusty Halverson and myself. Thanks for listening. Join us again next week.